Welcome to the PA Podcast. I'm Travis, and tonight's PA Spotlight will focus on one of my favorite actors of all time, Gene Wilder. We'll visit with author Brian Scott Mednick, who has written a book about Wilder titled Funny and Sad. It's a great book. And Gene Wilder has been in so many great films, you know, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, one of my favorites, Stir Crazy, which I saw when I was way too young to be watching, and my personal favorite, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Just to name a few, we could go on and on. And tonight's PA Spotlight question of the night is actually, what is your favorite Gene Wilder film? I mean, you could go into the ones that he did with Pryor, or, you know, stick with the childhood classic, Willy Wonka. I just love that film. I didn't like the remake of that, just because I just love the classic so much. But you can hit us up on Skype and answer that question at papodcast.com. What was your favorite Gene Wilder film? And it's time to introduce our guest. He's a native New Yorker. He was a graduate of NYU Film School. He's a freelance writer that has also written a couple of books, one of which is Funny and Sad, an incredible book about Gene Wilder. This book took 15 years for our guest to complete, but after personally reading it, I can say it's brilliant, one that you should pick up. Please welcome author Brian Scott Mednick to the program. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Travis.
How are you?
Okay, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing not too shabby. I hope this isn't a bad question, but to me, it just kind of sticks out. 15 years you worked on this book? Why so long, Brian?
Well, the consensus was, most of that was really, you know, just trying to get it published. But when you write about someone who's still alive, you're constantly making changes to the book. I mean, I could still, you know, it's been out over a year, and I could still make a bunch of changes because things always happen to someone. But the consensus among publishers when I first tried to get it published many years ago was that Gene Wilder really wasn't that hot anymore and that the book wouldn't sell. I got the nicest rejection letters. I'm telling you, I have literally hundreds of rejection letters. I don't think I ever got one letter that said anything negative about the book. They just didn't think it would sell. The publishing industry has changed so much in the last few years that with print on demand, a lot of publishers are willing to take risks on books that maybe won't be runaway bestsellers, but they don't have to print 5 or 10,000 copies and be stuck with them. So,
sure.
In a way, that's good. But I just always found it amazing that no one wrote a book about Gene Wilder, even in the 70s when he was really at the top of his game. And that was kind of one of the reasons why I tackle the project was because there hadn't been any books about it.
What were some of the things that you found out during your research that most people wouldn't really know about Wilder?
Well, there are a lot of things that, you know, people don't know about him, mainly because he is an intensely private individual. He rarely grants interviews and, he's just very, very private. So things that people might find surprising, I would say, maybe how intensely private and shy he is in real life. And the book is called Gene Wilder, Funny and Sad, because, you know, it's an old cliche, but it's true. So in a way, it's not a cliche because, like many funny people, his comedy is derived from pain, from sadness. And he had a very troubled childhood. His mother was had a heart attack when he was 8 years old. And the doctor told him two things that changed his life. The first one was, don't get angry or it'll kill your mother. And the second one was make her laugh if you can. So he started doing Danny Kaye routines and doing skits for his mother. And that's when he learned that being funny got him attention. And that kind of helped him as he, you know, as he progressed and he got a little bit older. And then he decided to pursue acting, to come out of his shell a bit, if you will. And as far as some other things people might find surprising, you know, and I'm not going to claim that I broke the bombshell here or anything. But
right.
He and Gilda didn't have the, you know, fairy tale marriage that everyone thought. And he admitted that in his own memoir, which came out about 5 years before my book. And it was, he found Gilda very difficult to live with. And it was kind of a one-sided marriage. And it was kind of very sad because she didn't even know that, you know. And it wasn't until he wrote his memoir many years after died that he basically admitted that she was very hard to live with. And as I say in my book, had she not gotten sick, it's unlikely that they would have continued to be married. So that's, you know, that's, I'd say, one of the sad parts, actually. But, you know, he has a very, very, you know, in addition to having a very diverse career and, you know, just an amazing list of classic films, you know, you mentioned in your introduction so many, and like you, I was too young when I saw Stir Crazy in the theater, but I loved it.
It was great.
And actually, Young Frankenstein is one of the first movies I ever saw in a theater. It's maybe one of the two or three first movies I ever saw. And I couldn't have been more than 6 years old, five or 6 years old. And I loved it. Now, I knew, I didn't understand the, you know, what knockers and all those adult jokes. You
right.
know? But, you know, I guess as a child, you know, there's something naughty going on. And
right.
It was just so funny. And still, it's just one of those great movies that, and he's made so many movies like that where you if you're watching them by yourself, you laugh out loud. That's really a test of a great comic, especially when you know the jokes. I remember I saw a revival of Young Frankenstein about 20 years in Manhattan, and it was so much fun because everyone in the theater were just Young Frankenstein junk. They knew the whole script by heart, so everyone was laughing like a few seconds before each punchline. And it's just one of those great movies. I think it's one of the most quotable movies ever made. Just a real genuine classic.
Right. Did Wilder do drugs or drink a lot?
Oh, you got me in a little bind there.
As far as you know.
As far as I know. Well, when he was younger, he's a wine connoisseur. And when he was younger, he drank a little bit too much, you know. He was never really a big part of the Hollywood scene. You know, he always kind of was removed from that. He was never a big party person. But when he's been married four times. Gilda was his third wife. But his second marriage, his fame, you know, he was really at the height of his fame, the early 70s. And he did drink too much, but, you know, he certainly wasn't what I'd call an alcoholic or anything. As for drugs, all I can say is there's nothing in the book that says, you know, Wilder ever did drugs. And, in fact, one of the reasons that when I write about his relationship with Richard Pryor, Gene is a very respectful, polite person. And, you know, he'd been asked, you know, why he and Richard Pryor never became great friends when they weren't working, you know, off screen. And he said, well, you know, if we hung out all the time, you know, we might become like Abbott and Costello and we'd get into a fight, you know. And he said, yeah, once in a while we'd have dinner or go to a movie, but, you know. And the real reason he and Pryor never became great friends off screen was because Richard Pryor was a hardcore drug addict.
Right.
You know, he was, I mean, when they made Stir Crazy, he literally separated himself from the rest of the cast and crew. He rented a house that was far away from the Luxury Hotel where Gene and Sidney Poitier stayed. His drug use resulted in him showing up on the set half a day late sometimes. The budget of Stir Crazy was $10 million, and it ballooned to $15 million because of Pryor showing up late all the time. And at one point, Sidney Poitier, who directed the movie, was going to replace him with another actor. And Gene never let it affect his relationship with Pryor, but Richard Pryor was a great talent, no question, but he could be very sweet and nice and sensitive, and he could also be irrational and just, you know, impossible to deal with. And that's really why he couldn't connect with Gene Wilder, you know. So, you know, that's you know, one of the unfortunate things. You know, you see these people who have such great rapport on screen.
Right.
It could be nice. Well, you know, I mean, like Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau really were best friends in real life, you know. You know, it's just, you know, that's, I think that's more a rare case, you know. Well, actually, Paul Newman and Robert Redford were also good friends. So it's just, you know, when you see people who have such a great rapport, you'd like to think that Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor were hanging out every
yeah.
weekend, you know.
And really, they weren't the greatest of friends. They just had a great working relationship.
Exactly. I mean, Gene Wilder visited Richard Pryor in the hospital after he had his accident with the fire. But, you know, I mean, there was a 9-year gap between Stir Crazy and See No Evil, Hear No Evil. And, you know, I think maybe there was a phone call every couple of years or something like that, but they really never saw each other, you know. So it wasn't until, you know, they got back together for See No Evil, Hear No Evil, and then they did another film 2 years later, their last film together, Another You. And during the making of those movies, they, you know, they saw quite a bit of each other, but also Pryor's health was kind of deteriorating from, you know, MS, and he was
right.
a little bit more mellow than he was, you know, when they did Silver Street and Stir Crazy.
You alluded earlier that there was a bit of a rocky relationship between Gene and Gilda, and things were not as happy as they seemed. How did Gene change after Gilda died?
Well, he never thought she was going to die. He really believed that she would pull through it, which he later said in retrospect was a good thing because he never showed her that he was scared that she wouldn't make it because he believed she would make it. And after she died, he said about 3 weeks before she died, he realized she wasn't going to make it. And he said Gilda realized she wasn't going to make it either. And it's very, very sad. But he started dating the woman who is his current and fourth wife, Karen, about 6 months after Gilda died. And they've been married 20 years. It's Gene Wilder's longest marriage. He's just nuts about Karen. They have a very, very good relationship. And they actually met before Gilda died. She was his speech therapist who coached him for his death role. It's See No Evil, Hear No Evil. So, you know, I mean, Gene Wilder actually, in the years following Gilda's death, has had a very, very happy life with his fourth wife, Karen.
How did you become so interested in Gene Wilder? Why was it Wilder for you that you decided to write your first book about?
Mainly because I was a very, very strange kid. I mean, when other kids my age were, you know, the big stars that everyone liked in school, they were, you know, when I was 11 years old, everyone was interested in Michael Jackson and Madonna and Ralph Macchio, and I'm interested in someone older than my parents, you know? And I addressed this in the introduction because that's what I always get is, you know, why Gene Wilder? And I think if you're one of those people like I was who grew up loving movies and your whole world was movies and entertainment and all that, and you wanted to pursue that, there's, you know, I think most lonely moviegoers have someone that they identify with. And I liked and still like and admire a lot of actors and filmmakers who I did, you know, when I was younger, but it was always Gene Wilder who I identified with the most. And as I say in the intro, comedy and tragedy, there's a very fine line. And that's really why I call the book Funny and Sad, because I can think of few actors who walk the tightrope of that better than Gene Wilder.
Talking with Brian Scott Mednick about Gene Wilder and the book Funny and Sad that Brian wrote. Where can they pick that book up at, Brian?
It's available on Amazon.com and also BarnesandNoble.com and through the publisher's website, which is BearManorMedia.com. And if you go to my website, BrianScottMednick.com, there's tons of info about the book.
Okay. Who were some of the people that were more helpful to you when you were gathering this information about Gene?
I was lucky to get a number of interviews with some of his colleagues, and the person who was just an absolute doll, I mean, just one of the nicest people you'll ever talk to, was Kelly LeBrock, who was the woman in red. And
yes, she was.
I was too young when I saw that movie also.
Oh, I think we all were, but I've still got it, you know, on DVD.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
It
and
is.
She was just absolutely amazing, just incredibly warm and open. And it was, you know, the thing about Gene Wilder, especially with the films he directed, the thing that people kept telling me was when he directed a film, he created a sense on the set that there was a real film family. And, you know, people who worked with him said they never had a better experience than when they worked on a film with him. And Kelly LeBrock said, you know, it was her first film. She was, you know, a model, and she was coaxed into doing the screen test, and, you know, they cast her. And she said, you know, he was just so wonderful and terrific, and it was such a great experience. And Fred Schuller, who was the director of photography for Stir Crazy, The Woman in Red, and Haunted Honeymoon, also said, he said, you know, he said, I fantasize sometimes that Gene will call me and say I'm directing another movie and I want you to photograph it, because he said just the joy of working with him was just so wonderful. You know, he said, you know, we'd all go out to dinner every Saturday night, and, you know, it was just a great film family, and we just had so much fun making the film, you know, the films. And yeah, Fred Schuller was great. I had dinner with Mel Stewart, who was the director of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Mm.
Gave me some great material. I spoke to a few of his step-siblings and a couple of other people. Arthur Hiller, the great director who directed Silver Streak and See No Evil, Hear No Evil,
yes,
also gave me some great material. You know, Gene didn't want to cooperate with the book, so initially I thought I'd have a very hard time getting people to talk to me. And there were a number of people who I contacted who would not give me an interview because it was not authorized. Bruce J. Friedman, who wrote Stir Crazy, said, unless Gene gives his blessing, I can't, you know, give you an interview. And that's fine. I mean, that's, you know, that's obviously their choice. But I got the people who did grant me interviews were incredibly open and really gave me some great stuff.
Well, it's amazing you could get anybody to talk about Wilder, you know, is, you know, he's just kind of intensely private. So he.
I think Travis, the reason people who did talk to him wanted to was because they had such adoration for him. I mean, like, you know, Fred Schuller and Kelly LeBrock just loved talking about their experience with him, you know. So it wasn't like anyone had, you know, anything bad to say about him. I mean, quite the contrary. I was hoping, you know, one person would say something just to break it up. But I mean, I think the people who did talk to me, you know, knew that there was only complimentary things to say about him, because they just said, you know, to work with him was just an absolute joy.
And the PA Podcast question of the night: what was your favorite Gene Wilder film? You can give us your answer on Skype at papodcast.com. Brian, what was your favorite Wilder film?
Well, you know, there are so many, and, you know, I'm kind of prejudiced. I really only think he made maybe two or three films that were not very good, if that even, you know, out of 22 feature films and three TV movies, actually four TV. But my favorite probably is Silver Streak, which is just, to me, it's just a glorious
moment.
It's why you go to the movies.
Beautiful.
You know, jam-packed with comedy and romance and suspense. And, I mean, on a technical level, you know, one of the great Henry Mancini scores that just amazingly overlooked. The music in the film is just beautiful. Gorgeously photographed by David Walsh. And just on every level, I just think it is a great film. It was a huge success at the box office when it opened in 76. And it got kind of mixed reviews when it opened, but it's a film that really over the years, it's now considered a classic. And it was ranked in the top 100 great comedies of all time by the American Film Institute. So I would say that. And, you know, but the close second is what most people would say, and what Gene Wilder considers his best film, which is Young Frankenstein.
That's
then,
Frankenstein.
Yeah. Very good. Very good.
Yes.
You know, and then you have, you know, The Producers and Blazing Saddles. And actually, one of the films that, you know, doesn't necessarily get mentioned when you talk about his great film is the first film he made as director, which is The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother, which is just an absolute great film. You know, a lot of people said he was too gentle, that he wasn't quite, you know, didn't quite go as far as Mel Brooks in terms of, you know, the naughtiness factor. But you could definitely see the influence of Mel Brooks. And, you know, in that film, he had the Mel Brooks stock company of Madeleine Kahn and Marty Feldman and Dom DeLuise. And just a great film. And thankfully, a lot of these films that were not available for a long time on video, they were out of print on VHS, and then they were just not on DVD. They're all out now. And, you know, if people have not seen The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother or The World's Greatest Lover, which is his second film as director, I highly recommend that they rent them. They're accessible now. And on both of those DVDs, thankfully, Gene did a director's commentary throughout the whole film, which is just wonderful to, you know, to watch the film and listen to his take on everything. So, you know, again, I'd say Silver Streak and Young Frankenstein, if those were the two I had to single out.
And when you're speaking about films, you know what you're talking about. You did go to NYU film school, didn't you?
I did, although considering some of my classmates, it doesn't necessarily mean I know anything about film.
You went back before they started letting James Franco in.
That's right. Yeah. James Franco was probably a very little boy when. James Franco was. Well, yeah, he was a little boy when I started in NYU film school.
He's still a little boy.
He's still. I did graduate.
Do you have an opinion about the nepotism that's going on in Hollywood right now? It's crazy.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say it's anything new, but it seems like it's gotten a little more prevalent. And you know, when people say, you know, what's the best way to, you know, have a career in show business, or, you know, to be a filmmaker or anything, it's not a joke when they say have a relative in the business, because it's unlike any other industry. I mean, it's not like where you can just, you know, go and study and do well and get a degree and then get a job doing what you want to do. And it's, you know, I watch the end credits of TV shows or movies a lot of times, and I'll see a supporting actor or actress or something, and the last name is, you know, a standout, that it's like, I wonder if that's so-and-so's son or daughter. And Then I'll go to IMDb, and I'd say about 8 out of 10 times, yeah, that's so-and-so's son or daughter. And I don't have a problem as much when they're talented. I mean, no one's going to discount Michael Douglas being an incredible talent. But Michael Douglas, you know, if his father was not Kirk, who knows if Michael Douglas would have, you know, had the career that he did, you know, or Rob Reiner, another great talent, but he got where he is because of his father. But again, they're great talents, so I don't have a problem with that really. But it's just, you know, it's the most incestuous, crazy, terrible, horrible, wonderful business in the world.
Absolutely. You know, you're an author. You make your money off of selling books. I'm sitting here holding my hard copy, looking through it, which is a ton of great pictures, by the way, in here. Really, really, really nice book. But what's going to happen with all the technology, all the changes to how we enjoy reading with the Kindles, Nooks, the e-readers, all this stuff that's happening? How is that going to affect you?
I think it's going to affect bookcase sellers the most, because I like an actual book in my hand.
Yes.
And I have so many books that I just love, and I have, you know, a bookcase that's just loaded with these books, and to me it's like nothing makes a room look better than a bookcase full of books. And it's just not the same experience reading something on a little screen. You know, I mean, there's a certain sensuality about holding a book and turning the pages, and it's just, you know, I mean, I have to accept the reality, which is that the Kindle is here to stay. And, you know, I think that's how most people are reading their books these days. And I don't like it, but, you know, that's the way it is. But I just hope, I have one author friend who is convinced that the print industry is dying. And, you know, I mean, that's just very sad, because to me, the actual, you know, feeling of having the book in your hand, and it's just not the same reading it on that little screen. So
what does that translate to as far as financially to the authors?
Well, I don't know what it is for most authors, and I think it probably varies from case to case, but interestingly, with the Wilder book, I actually make more money when people buy the Kindle. But
it's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. You know, that's just, you know, that's what my publisher told me. But, you know, I'd rather know that people are buying the hardcover, you know, the actual hard copy of the book.
Oh, yeah. So now you're in New York City. You've been there forever. Do you have an opinion on the Giants?
Wow, do you have the wrong person here? I know nothing about sports.
I was trying to get an inside track there, Brian.
I know they're a football team. I can see that.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I'm totally ignorant of sports. Although, in order not to totally fail on this question, Gene Wilder is a tennis nut.
Really?
And, yeah. That's one of the great loves in his life. He's always been very athletic his adult life, which may stem from the fact that he was a chubby kid. And he and Gilda started going together, she insisted to learn tennis, and he even built a tennis court on her property, which is the home that he continues to live in Stamford, Connecticut. And Gene is also a basketball fan. Gene and Gilda, I believe, I can't tell you, I think it might have been the Lakers, but I know they watched basketball. But Gene, you know, I don't know if he still plays as much anymore, but, you know, tennis is just, you know, he still goes to the U.S. Open every year, and, you know, it's a real tennis buff.
Yes, lot of famous writers have had dark sides. Do you have a dark side?
I certainly do, and I think that comes across in my second book, which is a short story collection called Drinking Games.
Okay. That's what you're working. You've done two books. That one's done. What other projects are you working on right now?
I've just started working on, of all things, a historical novel, which if someone had told me I'd be writing a historical novel, I wouldn't believe them. It's about Richard Nixon. And
I see your dark side coming out.
That actually wasn't the dark side. But,
okay.
But it's a historical novel, mostly comedic, hopefully kind of moving, about Richard Nixon and the rather odd relationship that he had with his butler. It's called Nixon's Butler. And it's fiction, but I'm going to include a lot of real-life events, and I've been doing tons of research on Richard Nixon in the last few weeks, so I'm hoping it turns out to be something that people really enjoy, both from a historical perspective and also, I think it's just a really kind of interesting story, you know, to take someone as fascinating, love him or hate him, as Nixon, and put him in this kind of fictional situation that, you know, he relies on his butler so much. And, you know, it's not Kissinger or the First Lady or anything like that, or the Vice President. It's his butler who he feels he can confide in. So, So Nixon's Butler is the next one.
And you mentioned Drinking Games. Can people get that on Amazon as well?
Yes, Drinking Games is available on Amazon as well, and also on my website, brianscottmedlink.com. There's plenty of info about Drinking Games as well.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us today. It was delightful. I love Gene Wilder. I learned a lot about him today. I really appreciate it. I would really encourage people to pick up the book, Gene Wilder, Funny and Sad, written by Brian Scott Mednick. Brian, again, thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to thank the PA team, Tag, BK, and Jen. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to the PA Podcast.